One, two, three.
Greetings and welcome to a joint TIU-TFC special broadcast. Today is Monday, 29th of March, the year 2010. I'm joined by Daryl. Daryl, good evening.
It's great to be back with you, Noel. You know, it's a lot of good stuff going to happen tonight, and I want to thank in advance Phil Turney and Mark Glenn's work with the gentleman we are bringing up right now. They deserve kudos for the interview that they did earlier on, and we're going to hopefully add a little value to that original interview tonight.
Absolutely. Let's bring in our guest, a special guest, Dr. Alan Sabrowski, PhD, University of Michigan, 10-year U.S. Marine Corps, and a graduate of the U.S. Army War College. Welcome, Alan.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Listen, it's a pleasure to have you on. Daryl mentioned this interview you did about 10 days ago, which is still going viral around the internet, which is great. You said several things on that particular audio, and we're not going to beat around the bush. You said 100% sure that Israel did 9/11, and you don't go into any conspiracy theories and, you know, all of this, you know, every single thing that's been brought up in the last 9 years. You brought 9/11 down to simplify it, if I may, that can explain it to the U.S. people, but specifically to the military. Can you go a little bit into that, please?
Just a bit right now, because some of the research is still out there in a couple of articles that are due to be published later this week. Basically, there are several parts that fit into this. Not in any particular order of importance for our discussion. One of it is that one of the first things in any type of a strategic analysis, when you're looking at an issue and you're not quite sure who or what may have been participants, is to ask yourself who benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, where are the payoffs?
Key bono. Yeah.
And that tends to be a very great discriminator. It eliminates an awful lot of possible participants and begins to focus on who's the beneficiary, you know, and other than a number of corporations who are making a great deal of money off of the wars, the only real winner from 9/11 and the wars that it spawned, Iraq, Afghanistan and Iraq, and of course Iran coming up to the front burner and Syria still simmering on the back burner, is Israel. No one else benefits. No other country benefits. That doesn't mean that people in the country don't benefit, but no other country does.
Yeah.
A second way of looking at it, and I'm just going to be mentioning a few of the things that have sort of led me to this. A second thing is to look at the requirements for the conduct of this type of an operation. I mean, even taking the U.S. government's case, neither Al-Qaeda nor any other terrorist operation in the world has the discipline, the skills, the coordination, anything else you wish, even to pull off a simultaneous four-plane hijacking, much less do what they did.
Well,
third, there's WTC-7, the collapse of the third tower.
Yeah.
Not hit by a plane, clear control demolition. And what really focused my attention on this, and as I mentioned when we spoke briefly before the program, you know, I was largely unaware of and almost indifferent to the details of 9/11 until about a year ago, even though I was opposed to the wars, was an interview with a Danish demolitions expert named Danny Jawenko. This guy brings down buildings for a living, and he was interviewed, I believe it was in April 2009, on Danish television, and it's available on YouTube and many other places. He wasn't even aware that WTC-7 had gone down. Simply wasn't even aware of it. And when he looked at it, and they said, we're going to show you a building going down, he sees the building going down, and it's obviously a building in an urban area, and he says, it's an offhand, he says, clearly a professional job. Look, control demolition, how it goes down. And then he says, what? That was WTC-7? The same day? Yes. He didn't know. He didn't know. And I looked at that, and whatever one might think of the people that were supposedly in the plane, and let's buy the USG case for a moment. Let's say they were all there, you know, that this was a four-plane hijacking, and they decided to do it. there is no way in the world they could have had access to a single WTC building, much less three of them, to wire them for demolitions and bring them down. I mean, their MO, you know, the Al-Qaeda and other terrorist MO, or freedom fighter MO, or whatever you want to call them, is either a car, a truck, packed with explosives and parked near something and detonated, or driven into something and detonated, or explosive tied around your person and you blow it when you're close to a target. That's light years from the capability to wire a massive building for a controlled demolition, much less carry off a four-plane hijacking.
Well,
different capabilities.
You brought up
Go
ahead, Alan.
You know, they didn't have the expertise. They didn't have the access. But one of the things that plays into this is that not only has the mainstream media done a really good job of disinformation and distraction and ridicule mm-hmm. when dealing with people who question the official case of 9/11, they have deliberately ignored their basic instinct since the Pentagon Papers were published in the latter part of the Vietnam War, which is to investigate and to reveal. And the fact that the numbers vary a little bit, 90 to 96% of the mainstream media in the United States are either Jewish or Zionist-owned.
That's right.
The fact that they have not done that there was a clamp on discussions about 9/11, on suppression of WTC-7, whose collapse is virtually unknown in America, makes it very clear to me that the people who run it either knew, suspected, or feared that the evidentiary trail an investigation would reveal would lead straight back to Israel. Mm. Otherwise, there would have been a feeding frenzy and they would have gone at it.
Well, you made an important point.
What people don't do is often as important as what they do.
You made an important point before we went on air about keeping it simple. And I agree. I think that's the best presentation. WTC-7 is a slam dunk for anybody looking at this. But we've also done work on many other areas, and I'm not going to go into them as a research item, but just to let people know that Al-Qaeda's origins and its continued support are riddled with intelligence people from Israel as well. Including people.
I've heard that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Now, here, listen to this one.
Oh, I know that.
The top Israeli, one of the guys that this guy, Adam, what's his name, Noel? Adam, he's the headed spokesperson for Al Qaeda in the United States.
Yeah.
Perlman. Well, Adam Perlman.
His
father was the ADL's, his grandfather was the head of the ADL on the west coast of the United States. And he's the spokesperson for Al-Qaeda. So, the whole idea is that this thing is, create an enemy and then have that enemy attack and then create the solution to that attack. But the knock-on, and I think this is important to mention, the real damage of 9/11 was the aftermath, as you mentioned, the wars that have happened, where we've got millions of dead and dying from illness and from displaced. We've had genocide. We've had ethnic cleansing. We've had theft and war crimes created in this last 10-year period unknown to America ever. I mean, except for what I can read about what we did to the American Indians. Nothing we've ever done is as heinous and as criminal as what we've seen in the last 10 years. And so what we want to do here is maybe to suss out how we can go forward and use your knowledge of the system to maybe come up with some good solutions. And I think Noel's got some questions about the military that he wants to talk about.
Well, Darrell, let's get down to the big question, Alan, which I've been asked many, many times during the week. As I said, your article that was published about 2 weeks ago has gone viral. The show you did with Mark, was a follow up to the article about Israeli nationalism and the threat it is for the rest of the world. The question I keep hearing is, with Alan's contacts in the military, where are we, where do we stand currently about the U.S. Army actually standing up for the Constitution and trying to remove these parasites and controllers? You know, we mentioned in the pre-conversation that the upper echelons of the military are probably lost to us, but we have this middle class, middle group in the Army, and the TIU or the people on the Info Underground want to know, do we have any hope? Will the American military come and help its people? And I think that goes for all peoples.
I think you would be completely misreading the American military if you thought that there was going to be a 7 days in May from the regiments. There's not going to be. I mean, it's not. It is not.
That's heartbreaking.
Happen.
That's heart wrenching.
That is, you know. And I will tell you, you know, I think that anyone who expects the, you know, regimental and brigade commanders and ship commanders and wing commanders to look out there and say, we don't, you know, this is wrong, we're going to stand up for it, you know, sort of a like the French army in North Africa, you know, revolting against the loss of North Africa, of Algeria. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It's absolutely not going to happen.
That's a shame.
You could not go to a regiment of Marines and order them to arrest the Congress and expect it to happen. It's not going to happen. I mean, it's just not. But here's the big but. There are two qualifiers on that. One is that the services, all of the services, have their own newspapers. They have their own professional journals, widely read, well thought of. None of which is subject to the censorship and control that the mainstream media is. They read. They look at it. You can hit them. And that can have an effect. Lots of people out there, someone told me that there are like 27 million veterans in the United States. You know, don't worry about trying to manipulate a specific lobby in Washington. If you're not going to look at the Veterans for Foreign Wars, the American Legion, each of the services has a veterans organization like the Association of the U.S. Army. There's money there, there's votes there, and as someone wrote about a week ago, you know, if you want to talk about the true 800-pound gorilla in the American lobby system, it's not AIPAC. It's the American military and the American veterans organizations. And if they ever get energized, that's where you can do it. That's where Congress suddenly changes. That's not just money. That's money and votes.
What is the current situation, Alan? If we're talking about a huge group, you mentioned 27 million veterans. I see some veteran groups out on the internet that are well aware of the crimes of these Israelis. And you said it's not every single Jew living in Israel, but the leadership, these extremists. But I mean, I don't see any big movement. I see these, you know, you were talking about that money. I see at least some of them dealing with the medical veterans starved of funds, or, you know, badly treated. And I see them trying to improve that because they're going to be needed again to go to war with Iran.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, there has not been anything to crystallize their opposition. This is a critical year. The next 3 to 4 months are going into an American congressional election year, and most members of Congress are extremely vulnerable. Not vulnerable because they don't come from safe districts. I mean, normally re-election is a given. But they're vulnerable when they go back to their home districts because the local media also is large, like the military and service journals. The local media also is largely not bought or censored by the Zionists. You know, the local newspapers, the local TV and radio stations, they have their own interests, and their interests are the local constituency. And these are the people that need to be hit. These are the people that need to be activated. And that's why, according to that principle we were talking about earlier, these are the ones who need to be the recipients of the message. Don't, you know, Congress in Washington, the mainstream media, this is the enemy's battleground. That's where they have, that's their strength. That's where they have their resources, their visibility, their access, and their numbers, and where the members of Congress are also largely immune from their own constituencies at home. The people there largely don't know what they do, and the members of Congress don't have to worry about them. But they all have to come home. They all have to come back, and in this election year, they have to come back. This is the level of the media that needs to be hit, and this is where veterans groups need to be addressed, not at the national level, because the national level of the veterans group is like the national level of most of them. It's also been compromised.
Could you recount
that? But the
local
ones have not.
Could you recount that little story, that little vignette you told us before we started the show about the control of our congressional offices and access to it? Because I think it's telling. We have similar stories from Paul Finley and from Representative.
Right. Sorry.
Great. That's a great story.
We talked about both finances and personal. Sure, I'll be happy to.
Yeah.
Just one second. Back in the 1980s, I taught a couple of courses. Are you still there?
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead, Al.
Sorry, the line almost went dead for a second. My apologies.
No problem.
Back in the 1980s, I was teaching a couple of courses at Georgetown University while I was still at the Army War College. I had an adjunct professorship there. One of them was in comparative foreign policy. And every semester I taught it, I would have people from three or four different embassies come to the course, talk about their country's policies, and then the class would discuss it. And it was always very interesting because how these people presented their arguments and what they chose not to talk about was often as instructive as what they did. On one of these occasions, and I think looking back on it, it probably would have been in either 88 or 89. I had invited someone from Israel and had a young diplomat come in there who told us later that he had emigrated to Israel from Romania. And he gave a very interesting discussion, and we had a good discussion in the class. And afterwards, I took him and two students to dinner for a more informal talk and discussion and so forth. And in the process of that, one of the students asked something about the 1956 crisis, the Suez crisis, where Britain, France, and Israel attacked Egypt, and Eisenhower, who was the next to the last American president to stand up to Israel, the last one being John Kennedy. Eisenhower had ordered Britain, France, and Israel out. And this Israeli diplomat said that the Israelis tried then to go to Congress to get support from Congress to basically override Eisenhower, because as I'm sure you guys know, but many of your listeners may not know, in the American system, because of the rather odd structure of the constitutional government, you know, congressional supremacy inheres in the constitutional order. A president can start a war, but all the money bills, everything else is in the Congress. So the Congress, if it chooses, can override the president. The president has much less flexibility with regard to Congress. And what this Israeli diplomat said is that when they tried to go to Congress, they found that they had access only to two minor congressional offices, and that was his phrase. And he said something to the effect then, and so we realized that things had to change, and so we set about changing them. So this is in 1956. Mm-hmm. So this would be sometime end of 56, early 57, that they set about to change things. And one of the students asked, well, how many congressional offices do you have access to now? And what I remember most was not his words, but his smile, because he leaned back and with a big smile, he said, almost all of them. And yeah. The two students stared at him. Remember, this was the late 80s, 88, 89. Just stared at him. He looked at the expression on his face and said, oh, but of course, they always act in the best interest of the American people. And the students looked at each other and looked at me, and I said, right. know, and I work for the tax agency, and I'm here to help you.
Yeah.
But that's when it happened, and that was when the turn came politically. And I found that to be a very, very fascinating commentary because clearly, once they put their minds to it, they began doing a great deal. And of course, it was just a few years after that that the transformation into AIPAC took place, that the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations coalesced and began increasing its organizations. And I haven't looked at it, but I would make a reasonable guess that about that time you began seeing a major increase in Jewish contributions, campaign contributions, to members of Congress.
Well, I think you're absolutely. I think the paper trail, you know, followed the money. It's clear without going too far into it. 60% of all monies given to you know either party comes from a Jewish interest or pro-Jewish or pro-Israeli interest. I think that's easily proven. But you know what's more, these congressional. Coming up in a couple of months, I don't think they're as important as to what happened last week. You have 7,500 pro-Israeli AIPAC in a big room, and they're doing all their little meetings and little side bets on who they're going to elect. They're well aware that some of these politicians, as you said, Alan, are going home and they're going to feel the heat, but they'll have replacements. That's how it works. I mean, sure. Congress is bought and paid for, and anyone hoping that we go to Congress to solve this the Zionist problem is nuts.
Yeah, I think that's not likely to happen either. But what my interest is trying to, I suppose, not so much inform or not only inform, but inflame the public. Someone. About what's happening. I mean, they're already unhappy. They're not only unhappy with the economy, they're unhappy with the war. There's a simmering unhappiness out there, you know.
Yeah.
Too much is going too wrong in too many different ways, and they're looking at the light at the end of the tunnel, and some of them are beginning to suspect that it may be a funeral pyre.
That's right.
Certainly for a lot of their hopes, certainly for their economic plans. It's there's just too much, and you guys know that as well as I do.
Absolutely.
But one of the comments that I got after my interview with Mark and Phil was that I'd used some fairly inflammatory language, and
which we fully encourage, by the way.
Pardon me?
Which we fully encourage.
Well, you know, I thought I was being actually very restrained for a Marine.
Well, don't restrain yourself.
Well, come on, now, since I'm talking about military here.
Yeah, you know, U.S. Marines are not exactly known for their general restraint. If they were, they wouldn't look at frontal assaults on beachfront properties like Iwo Jima as a neat thing to do.
Hmm.
But what I remarked to them, I said, you know, there are two things to this. I said, one is that sometimes people need to be inflamed.
Yes.
Not just informed, but inflamed.
Yeah.
And the example I gave, and it, I hate to use Hollywood on this, but I said the example I gave was an old movie that I saw in the 1950s, which should tell you exactly how old I am. Well, not really exactly, but, you know, back with Methuselah, he and I were on the same ship.
Yeah.
was that it was one of these grade B Hollywood movies, and this was long before race was an issue, so every single person in it was white. Okay, so the racial issue was zeroed out. And they had a case in which it was in small town America, and a little girl had been gang raped and murdered by a bunch of guys, and they were in the courtroom looking predictably scruffy. And the prosecutor went off on them in front of the jury, and the judge rebuked him for his inflammatory language. And the prosecutor said, you know, Your Honor, sometimes people need to be inflamed. He said the jury needs to be so inflamed at what happened to this little girl that they leap out of the jury box and beat these people to death in front of everyone. Now, because this was a Hollywood movie, everyone went, oh, how terrible, like this. But I figured that the girl's parents would be standing up and cheering. And it's the same way looking at this issue. what happened was so heinous. So many people have died, not just Americans, but people in the other countries. There has been so much death and destruction and so much cost. People don't, in America and elsewhere, don't simply need to be informed. They need to become enraged. Need to be inflamed.
Well, I've called for it, Alan, to be, if you're not angry, you're not normal.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, they don't know. They simply don't know. You can't give them a complicated message.
You mentioned it in your previous audio. Myself and Daryl have spoken about it many times. And we proved the point about 10 days ago ourselves in an online chat between a couple of people that were physically in speaking distance with Daryl on Skype. And we had an American guy in his 50s, very well informed, knows a lot about the world, he can talk about any issue. And, you know, I came up about 9/11, and this guy, he's a client, the guy can talk. And Daryl and myself, I think at the same time, we said Building 7. And while we were saying it, I showed him a YouTube clip of Building 7, you know, 5.6 seconds, 47 floors down. And he said, what was that? And I said, Building 7. He said, what was that? I said, that was on the same day as 9/11. And his answer was exactly, but I didn't know. But then again, that brings us into the control of the media. You've stated, from my research and Daryl's, is the same, 96% of the mainstream radio, TV, magazines, newspaper are controlled by Zionist Jews. Murdoch is, a case in point. That this plan, 9/11 was a military operation carried out by Israeli forces.
With their dual citizen helpers in the United States government.
With the dual citizens, and even in Congress, I mean, they seem to be all over the place. But in your opinion, Alan, when would you have an idea of when the plan for 9/11 originally took place? Or took place, sorry.
I can't even get, as you said that, I knew which way the question was going, and I was trying to think of that. I would guess that the idea for it, either after Oslo or after Madrid.
Yeah, mm-hmm. After the Madrid.
That would have been a motivation for it.
I would have said mid-80s, but that's a very, very, it's a very plausible.
Yeah, somewhere within that framework, because, to them, while the states around them are the Arab states around them, and the Arab states in Iran, of course, are the external targets, their primary drive is the cohesion and internal stability of Greater Israel.
I'm gonna part company with you on that.
Palestinians are the disruption.
I gotta part company with you on that particular statement. I think their goal, their principal goal, is world domination. There's enough ancillary conspiracies running parallel to this one that tell me financially, media-wise, and the nations that are lining up behind them, this is a push for global governance, and you can see the all of the underpinnings of that global governance in their direction as we speak, and it's broken down into three regions, and we can see how they're setting up these control mechanisms and control points, and I have to say that their biggest worry, I don't think, is Palestine at the moment, but rather to take full control of this earth, and I see them doing it, in fact, and it's working for them in many ways.
We're not saying different things. I didn't say that was their, say anything about their principal objective or their long-term objective. I've said their primary concern.
Mm.
The difference between a concern and an objective are not the same thing.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Okay, their primary concern in terms of things that can cause them problems. It's not the Palestinians per se. It's that there's a lot of folks out there who see what's happening and aren't quite as subject as the American people to that level of censorship. It's the sort of things where they can be publicly embarrassed by a Goldstone putting a report down, and they find it really difficult, you know, to slap him back. That the Palestinians are a potential, as long as they are within their borders, they have the potential to focus outside attention on them before they have the freedom of maneuver they need to pursue other long-term objectives. You know, we're still at a preliminary stage, and they know this. And these people, as I said, you know, these people are not fools by any means. They couldn't have done as much as they have with their numbers and their money if they were. And that's why I think that the focus on Iran, this perpetual drumbeat on this existential threat from Iran, is designed to precipitate a war, an American attack on Iran, hopefully without any of their involvement, so it'd be American lives and money instead of any of those, like, you know, like the last couple of wars. to do that, to expect, I mean, from their perspective, from the Israeli perspective, to expect a good deal of the Arab street to explode, no matter what their governments do. And that while the United States is running its way through this morass, you're going to see a double type of ethnic cleansing in Palestine. The IDF and armed settlers pushing what's in the West Bank into Jordan. The IDF pushing the people of Gaza into the Sinai, and I think I can be reasonably safe in saying that the Egyptian army will not fight the IDF. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't even make open bets on the Arab population, the Arab citizens of Israel. I wouldn't make any bets on them at all. And that when this and that resolves their internal security problem, you know, no more need for barriers, no more need for fences, no more need inside for that. That eliminates the demographic issue. No worry about a Palestinian or Arab population becoming a majority, because there won't be a Palestinian or Arab population to deal with. And no one else, including the United States, will do anything, because you're going to have general convulsion in a post-Iran war situation. I think that's a very, very plausible scenario. Not a pleasant one, but I think it's a plausible one. And I would be surprised if that was not the way the game plan was laid out.
I have a question for you, Alan, about your roots in the Jewish community. You obviously have Jewish heritage in some parts of your family. And I also want to bring up for you the others that have worked hard from the Jewish community to fight back against what I know is one of the worst crime waves the world has ever known. It may be the worst, because it is encompassing the whole globe now as we speak, so it probably is the worst. We've seen Benjamin Friedman, who came out against this crime gang. He was part of the signing of the Versailles Treaty. He was there with Morgenthau and Untermyer and Bernard Baruch and all of these people. He watched them sign. He was there when the Zionist Samuel Untermyer declared war on Germany in the 1930s and got their newspapers to come out against Germany and switch the allegiance against Germany from a pro-German to an anti-German allegiance by using their media. He was there all the way through the 40s, and this man spent his own fortune and his own blood and his own future to try to secure the truth on behalf of the rest of us. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I'm encouraging other Jewish people who have no interest in being part of this crime wave, and many people in the Jewish community, I'm sure, don't want to be if they knew the facts. So could you address for us, because, you know, we there's a lot of people out there that don't want anybody from the Jewish community involved in the fight. They think that the – and you said it on the Tierney and Mark Glenn show that – there may be a pogrom from this that erupts, and you might end up being victimized because of your heritage. What could you do to address that particular element within this fight? Because we have Jack Bernstein, we have Myron Fagan, we have so many people out there. Israel Shahak, wrote an incredible book about this, the facts around Zionism. My point is that I would like you to maybe address that, because we have to in our emails. Alan? Alan, I asked about your ethnicity, being from the Jewish community, at least partly in your family, and I've been fighting for the recognition of a lot of quality people from the Jewish community who fought back, including Ben Friedman, including Myron Fagan, including Jack Bernstein, including Israel Shahak, including so many. And because I don't want innocent people from any community to be you know, blamed for something that they're fighting against, certainly, or are not supporting in the second instance. But at the same time, I've also known that these people would have some access into the Jewish community to be able to start informing them. Although I do know the brainwashing of Jews is worse than even the brainwashing of Americans, so it's going to be a tough slog. Could you address for my listeners and for Noel's listeners, because we take a lot of flack for inviting Jews to participate in this war with us against these criminals, because a lot of people believe the entire community is compromised, and my goal is to bring anybody who's of goodwill into the fight with us. So could you maybe address that for us? You had to address it, I know, and you said it might cost you in a pogrom that could develop as a result of this. And could you go further on that subject?
Only just at a very general level, because as I wrote in a piece I did for Phil Weiss on Mondo Weiss, you know, the blog that's run by a couple of American Jewish guys, said, you know, I define my Jewish identity in cuisine, not foreign policy. I have one Jewish grandparent who is not observant. I have no real ties into the Jewish community. I have a lot of Jewish friends. I've been to Reform congregation services on a number of occasions with friends. My problem has never been with, for, or about Jews. It's with an armed Zionist state.
Yep.
That's where the issue is. And in fact, I did a follow-on to the one on Jewish nationalism on anti-Semitism, and pointed out that seems to be the breaking point, that without an armed state, Jews tend to be very progressive, civil libertarians, high achievers in almost every one of the fields that are out there. But when there is an armed Jewish state, they do a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde transformation, not all, but in large number, you know, and sort of the dark side of the force.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Israeli expatriates. I'm in regular contact with a number of them who were born in Israel and finally said not only no, but hell no, and left. There's a lot of Jews in America who are very unhappy with the way this is going and have difficulty publicly dealing with it, because most of them now have relatives. There are settlers. You know, which really complicates the entire.
Do you believe
game.
That the American public is priming itself for a backlash against against Jewish people and Zionism?
I don't think it's priming itself for any kind of a backlash, and I don't think it knows it. What I said on the show with Mark and Phil is that if Americans really understand, ever feel that. One, 9/11 was orchestrated by Israel, regardless of the character of the participants. Okay, let's not worry about the character of the participants right now. But if it was orchestrated by Israel, facilitated or concealed or both by prominent members of the American Jewish community in or out of government, and they look at the casualties, and they look at the losses, and they look at what we've done, there's going to be an explosion.
Yes, there will be.
I mean, the odds on an explosion are really high, and I don't think that there's going to be a terribly great deal of discrimination, you know, asking how many grandparents one had.
I think you're right.
Before the process proceeds.
Yeah,
you know,
I think you're right.
I don't say that with any pleasure, and I'm not trying to be predictive about it. But I understand a fair amount about group dynamics in any population, and you know that was one of the reasons why in Germany, whatever the actual character of the Holocaust, and the Jewish population in Germany was probably the most assimilated of any country in Europe.
That's right.
The certainly on the continent. I don't know about Britain and Ireland and Scotland, but certainly on the continent. And it was that when the reaction was, when there was an understanding that this was really bad, people who would not have had thought they had a bone in their body that disliked Jews didn't necessarily actively participate, but they didn't say no.
Well, but you know, one of the things, Alan, that we have to bring out here is that the Jewish community was instrumental in fleecing Germany after World War I. It was them that were pushing for all of the sanctions and the repayment scheduling and all of the horrible conditions that were put upon it after World War I.
It wasn't even that seemed to have been the driver.
Well, the driver was the thing.
The driver was that so much of the. Was that the Spartacist rising, the strikes at the end of the war that the Germans saw as the stab in the back.
That's right.
Led by the German Communist Party, which was led by Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht.
That's right. And the Declaration of War.
Focus.
But the Declaration of War done by the Jews in the United States against, they said, Samuel Untermeyer did a speech, and it said in the 1930s that we Jews declare all-out war against Germany, and that was in the 30s. So the Germans knew right away that they were persona non grata in the Jewish community, and that way they've been targeted. Yeah.
I don't think that's the phenomenon in America. I see here more than that, when you were talking about what the reaction was in the Jewish community, is that just in the last 3 to 4 years. There's a growing number of American Jews who are speaking out on a host of different websites, mm-hmm. a lot of different blogs,
yeah.
that are really taking lead on this. And that whether it's a sense of history, a sense of ethics, or whatever it is, that's rattling the edges of the AIPAC dominated box.
Yeah, but let's not forget, Alan, that they also have a lot of paid pro-Israel Jews, American Jews online with their blogs that are giving us nonsense morning, noon, and night.
Yes,
and they by far outnumber the honest Jewish people that are, you know, that are blogging and that are outraged
9/11
by
9/11.org and the rest of it,
the genocide and ethnic cleansing that's currently going on, you know, which is still going on today.
Yeah, I've been on the receiving end of some of the attention of the Hasbro crowd, I can assure you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad you addressed that. I think it was important because that we receive a lot of that those emails that say, well, how is he going to be for the truth if he's from this community? And I think putting that out there in the first instance gets people to understand that this is not an issue of – this is an American and world issue. The French are involved in this, and the French public needs to become aware of what their military is doing in Afghanistan. And the British are killing indiscriminately in both countries. And we're looking at horrendous acts being committed by countries around the Western world. At the same time, their financial arm is fleecing each of these countries in wholesale. You can't go very far and not see that the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been stolen out of the public purse. And this is one of the things you talked about, where there's a palpable anger in the communities around the world. Their countries are going in the wrong direction. Well, a lot of it has to do with being robbed wholesale by Zionist Jewish bankers. And you can see this anger is growing. And in Britain, they're actually putting more and more on television about how this is happening and why.
Well,
and
I think, Daryl, maybe we should introduce Alan to a word when we're discussing these people that work for Zionist interests in the UK. There's an article on reddress.cc, which has lots of posts of Alan on that site, very good site. And they have a new word, Alan, for this Israeli lobby in the UK, and it's called cabbing. I know Daryl as well, he posted on his site. And it's basically cab for hire, where all the politicians, they're bringing out documentary after documentary about how these, you know, Friends of Israel and the Israeli lobby in the UK have control of all three parties, and, you know, probably including the BNP, so the fourth party, and if there's any independents, that we see this... recent spate between the U.S. and Israel over the settlements, 1,600 illegal in East Jerusalem. But that seems to be all, you know, a design, staged, a complete fake argument. I was reading one that were saying that, you know, the bond between the U.K. and America is lost. I don't think it has. It's just Israel is playing the middleman, or the Zionists are playing middlemen.
Interesting.
It's an interesting word, cabbing, cab for hire, and most of anyone that's been, UK MPs, and have been caught on sting camera operations in the last couple of weeks, and even after the story broke, a couple more got caught the same day. They're up for hire. Anything you want for Israel, 3,000 to 5,000 a day.
Well, but see the false fight. Why don't you address that, maybe, Alan? The false fight that has been developing between they're saying Obama's anti-Israeli, anti-Jewish. At the same time, they
called him anti-Semitic, Darryl.
Yeah,
well,
they did. They called him anti-Semitic, and at the same time, they're signing off $30 billion worth of additional military supplies to be shipped to Israel. I mean, it's nonsense that there's a fight going on. There is no fight. The whole thing is just a staged a farce. It's farcical. And I'm wondering if you've been abreast of some of the developments in this fraudulent rift that they're saying has developed.
Well, whether it's fraudulent or not, the Obama, even if Obama wanted to do something, yeah. Let's give him just for a brief second the moment of a doubt, okay? Even if he wanted to do something, he has two major problems. One is Rahm Emanuel.
That's right.
Who, as chief of staff of the White House, and his first appointment, and I saw that and I said, not a good idea. As chief of staff in the White House, is de facto the second most powerful person in the country.
That's right.
And second, obviously, is the Congress. And we just saw the recent letter plowing into the president, basically telling him
300 members of Congress.
Do whatever Israel wants. Let me play devil's advocate for just a second, and I think this will illustrate the problem that you've highlighted. Let's say Obama, in his heart of hearts, really meant the Cairo speech. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say he really meant that. If he tried to do that, if he really tried to do that, his entire administration's policy would collapse because of Congress.
Mm-hmm. He'd be Jack Kennedy'd.
Whether he would be Jack Kennedy or a one-term president, his administration's policy would collapse, and he would not be in office after 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very clear political reality. And any president who tries to ignore that reality does so at the peril of his entire administration's agenda.
But his agenda is only Israeli. His agenda is completely Zionist.
No, you're missing this on it. Because, I mean, in the foreign policy, yes, I understand that. But the primary, the parties in America differ in one way. The Republican Party has always been more interested in foreign affairs than the Democrats since Vietnam. And for the Democrats, for Obama, every bit as much as for LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, what's happening out there in the world is a distraction from dealing with the domestic economy. That's the heartland of the Democratic Party. They have had one president, Truman, whose party lost the election, the Democratic Party lost the election to Eisenhower because of one war, Korea. They had a second one under Lyndon Johnson. His successor lost the election. His successor as candidate for president lost in 1968, and his party lost big to Richard Nixon and the Republicans. they saw a third president, Dub Bush, not only lose but have his party get slaughtered because of a pair of ongoing wars. Whatever else, they don't want to go there. They really don't want to go there. They're not going to back away from it if Israel pushes them, but they really have to be dragged kicking and screaming into it. I have no doubt that if McCain had been elected, we would have already attacked Iran.
I have to maybe part company. I don't believe there's a dime's difference between any of these people.
I have to say,
it's a matter of priority.
I don't think so. I think at the highest level, the goals remain the same in both parties. The ownership of those two parties are both owned by the same people. And if you want to go up against anybody in the country, Barack Obama is not the president of the country. Bernanke and his controllers run the country. They always have. And the simple truth of the matter is, it's the money that pushes everything forward. And as long as Barack Obama is a meat puppet, this man doesn't have any real chops whatsoever. And you know, Axelrod runs things along with Rahm Emanuel, and he's just standing up there doing the minuet dance. And there isn't a single thing that he cares about other than getting the policies of the Zionists into place. And when the Republicans are in there, they do the same thing.
Aside from the money issue, I stand by this statement. If John McCain had been elected, we would have already attacked Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we haven't done that yet, and we're having to be dragged into that direction, is a function of the very different domestic constituencies.
Well, I think it would be quite silly to assume, you know, that Barry Sotero actually went to Washington to try to get rid of the lobby, when it's clearly that he was backed. You know, he came from nowhere,
this guy.
We know nothing about him. A lot of Jewish money behind him. And this guy was a selected member, and he's just doing his job. You know, they're good at doing their little photo ops, but there's, you know, both parties are the same. Alan, I like your little describing that, you know, the left Democrats as, you know, more internal and the Republicans as being more external world affairs, but both sides of the same coin, absolutely controlled by Jewish money. We have a printing press that is owned by private people from the same tribe, and, you know, the puppets that they put up to Washington, you know, if it isn't them, they'll have, you know, another gay politician to come and replace them. It's wherever their money. The biggest thing that happened this year is what they did at APAC last week, and it's amazing. You get 7,500 people in a room, and all we hear about is what Hillary Clinton said. We don't hear about all the deals going on, and these people have already selected their next. You know, if this guy was didn't hold up his weight for Israel in Congress, he's out, and a few of them will have to bite the bullet and get retirement money and whatever. But, you know, these people have the next 535 members, or very close to it, selected. They've taken the pledge. Congresswoman McKinney told me on an audio that before you get to Washington, D.C., you make the pledge. The pledge is, what is the capital of Israel? Jerusalem is their answer, not our answer, not the world's answer, not the different bodies around the world, that you take the pledge in a written or oral format, that you're on the record. You are also accepting Jewish money to get into power. But these people don't seem to me in any way be representing their local constituents. They're there. They know that as soon as they get to Washington, they get all the money and the hookers and young boys and drugs and whatever else is going on there. That, you know, one of the biggest problems we have dealing with Zionism is the state, is Washington, D.C. in its totality. I'm talking Federal Reserve, Central Private Bank, the Senate, the Congress, all controlled by the same people. I mean, not part of the U.S. under different laws from the U.S. With the District of Columbia, their own police force and whatever. And people can check into this. We have a problem. We can see the hand of this pro-Israel, pro-Zionist, absolutely controlling the whole place. And I get mad, and I'm only Irish. I still don't understand why the Americans, some are very, very angry. And I think tonight, Alan, you said that the military isn't going to help them, which is a bit of a downer for me a little bit earlier in the show. And let's hope you're wrong about that. But you've given a doomsday scenario.
Not really a doomsday scenario. I said it's not going to help in the sense of marching against the government. It's absolutely not going to do that. But I also said that, you know, you've that in the American system, you know, that the military people, their families, the veterans organizations have an enormous clout. You know, they don't use it. They generally don't use it for anything except, you know, veterans care, veterans benefits, things like that. But that is the potential target. That is the target audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't.
Well, I think it's interesting.
It isn't going into the street and waving signs, because these people are largely not going to go into the street and wave signs.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them will react emotionally, as I would, because the people who waved signs in the streets the last time I was out there were waving them against me.
Against you, yeah.
And my instinctive emotional reaction is, if you're for it, I'm against it, and I don't care what it is you're for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the mechanism approaching these people has to be different than, you know, street theater, public demonstration, and that. But this is the target audience that's actually at the cutting edge of the sword.
Well, I think it's
the great fear of AIPAC, and I'm positive of this. The great fear of AIPAC is that someone will be able to tap in to the military, not as an organized unit, but as people, and the veterans organizations, because that is the one lobby, collectively speaking, in America that can make them history.
Alan, after you did your last show, I was talking to a few people, Daryl included, and I had a simple question, Daryl. We're talking about U.S. military, ex-military, retired, and you know, whatever, in Navy, Army, the whole lot. How many, in your opinion, do we have living that would be demolition experts, that are experts with you know, explosives? And I tried to think of a number, and I came up with a number of 200,000. I said living. I don't know how many are serving. Would you have any opinion how many living demolition experts train, you know, I'm talking Navy SEALs, I'm talking, you know,
Army,
people like Jesse Ventura.
Much smaller number.
Yeah,
much
I would say about,
number
than about
that
15,000.
Who would have the expertise. People who know weapons and demolitions is one thing.
Yeah.
But people who would have the ability to, you know, to wire a building. Most military demolitions experts, you slap an explosive along the side, you blow out a wall, and you go.
Mm-hmm.
Combat engineers are mostly that. The people who have the very specific skills, and understand, it's not just to bring down a building, it's to bring it down in an extremely small footprint, straight
down
vertically. Just watched it. Now, if WC-7 had fallen over on its side, you know, you've got a lot of people who could blow enough off of the base to topple it.
Mm-hmm.
But to bring it straight down, just like an arrow, you know, being going into the ground, that takes expertise. And that Danny Jawenko, the Danish guy I mentioned early on, when he's looked at that, he said, that's a very professional job. Look how they've done it.
Well, Dutch TV had an expert on about 4 or 5 years ago, and the guy said, no, no, no. And then they showed him Building 7, and he said, oh, no, that's absolutely a controlled demolition. So what are we talking about? A couple of thousand? You know, I'm talking about retired. A couple of thousand, 10,000, 2,000?
I couldn't even guess. I would not have a clue. I would, if I gave you a number, it would
ballpark.
Be what we call a wag, a wild-ass guess.
Well,
you know, I wouldn't have a clue.
I'm going to make a statement here that I believe, and I think it's just happening now, with the collapse of our financial structure, which is happening as we speak. It's an ongoing thing in the news every day. People aren't showing up to buy the treasuries. The dollar is in big trouble and going to get much worse. We're looking at 1930s on steroids, and that's just around the corner for everybody. Foreclosure rates that have never been matched in American history, and it's happening in Britain as well. We're looking at a country so angry and so inflamed. We're looking at 200 million private guns, 6 billion bullets, which is the lead in those bullets is the real precious metal,
yeah.
And then 27 million veterans who know how to load, lock and load. We're looking at the potential of a real situation, and I have to say that's not off the table, Alan. And as a military man, you know that you push people too far anywhere in the world. The history has so many examples of it. It's not worth even mentioning. You push them too far, and they are getting pushed too far as we speak. You cannot be sure of the outcome, and the outcome, I think, with the American public is certainly in flux right now. And would you agree with that?
I think that's too apocalyptic. It's going to have to get a lot worse, much, much worse economically before anything could go that way, and I don't think it would go that way. There has to be some, I'm going to sound like PNAC on this, there has to be a catalytic event. It can't be a gradual slide. There has to be some catalytic event.
Something that would
ignite it.
Wake possibly up, everybody!
A nuclear hit, a nuclear strike on a friendly city.
Whatever. There would have to be something.
Not just the casual side,
but a kick in the teeth. Pardon me?
Yeah, interview is one of those kicks in the teeth. There's been 100 kicks in the teeth.
Well, sometimes it takes that.
Alan, just look at your last interview. We're looking forward to your next part two of this your 9/11 article. But I mean, just listen, from your interview with Phil and Mark. I mean, that's gone viral. It's all over the internet, and we could do something. You know, get the truth out, and people could grow up a lot faster. We have we have the internet, and I don't think you can compare it to news say 20 years ago, 30, 40, 50 years ago, where they had control of the mainstream media. They own it. The internet, for the moment, they're after us all over the place, about censorship and whatever. But this message can become viral, and we can stop these people. I'm not taking it as a slam dunk that they're going to, murder, a couple of million Iranians and hit Syria. I go along with that. And if that did ever happen, Alan, and I'm sure I know you do agree, the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are going to be ethnically cleansed, or they're going to be pushed out or pushed into the sea.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. The Palestinian situation is very sadly going to be linked very, very explicitly to what happens to a war with Iran. I think that would be the cover for it.
Well, I think and the so, war you know, with
it's,
Iran
it's
might
every,
be.
It's in our interest and everyone else's to try and keep that war from happening, just to keep the other situation open.
I think that war with Iran might be the final outrage, that you were talking about, the catalyst. And we don't need to be hit with another city's attack. All we need is enough people saying, "Look, we can't afford to pay my children's school system anymore, and we've just had to close down three of our police department substations, and there's no fire department, and there's bankruptcy in all of my neighborhood, and there's for sale signs on every house, and there's homelessness under the bridges as I go onto the auto route and to the interstate system." And the simple fact is there's outrage everywhere, and then they go out and spend another $1 trillion on a war that we didn't need. The simple fact is I think the American people are approaching fed up, and they don't know yet why there is why they need to be outraged as much as we need to tell them. But I think the message is getting out, and I've watched it grow. 5 years ago, I was attacked by everybody for saying that Israel did this. I knew 5 years ago that this was the truth, and I had the facts already. It's taken me this long to get you on board, Alan, and the rest of the people, but now there's a cascading effect happening. And I'm telling you that the waking up is happening in mass, and it's going to happen in a way that's going to shock the world. And I think we're already well down that road. And I've got a 5-year track record of being able to track these events. And I think we're farther down the road to waking up the world than anyone thinks. And that's what I believe. What do you think, Alan?
I think we made an enormous amount of progress.
Yeah.
I just hope it isn't too little too late.
Me too.
That's reality. The progress is there, but they know it's happening. The Zionists know it's happening. They know the progress is being made.
And I think they're fighting it everywhere they can, but they're finding it more and more difficult.
They're losing.
I mean, you hear reports coming out of every country in the world that are aware of what's going on. You know, you've 100 million people looking into 9/11 all over the planet. If you know, and most of these people aren't stupid and know it. They've come across WTC7, and we agreed prior to the show. Keep it simple, stupid. It's something I've grown up with, and I absolutely believe. We start off about 9/11. How do we wake people up? We're talking about the military. They have a lot of access, or we've noticed that the military access has been cut off for certain sites. But if they actually seen WTC7 go down in 5.6 seconds, there's no other conclusion, Alan. If we can kind of sum it off here on 9/11, the smoking gun was Building 7. Now, we don't want to get into, you know, space beams and all the other nutty, and there's, you know, there was no planes, and there's a million other theories deliberately brought out to pollute the truth, the real truth movement, which has been quite infiltrated. But the basic 9/11 is WTC7, and then you can get into the auxiliary thing. You know, who were the owners of the towers and the security companies, and it's wall to wall Jewish companies. And I would urge people, go to your favorite search engine, type in Israel did 9/11. You'll probably end up first thing to the Info Underground. Alan, I believe you read the article posted by that young chap today. That will give you the background details. It might, you know, might be missing some other aspects, but that will give you a very, very good background into what happened on 9/11, who were the characters involved. But as we said, Building 7, explain it to us. You know, it doesn't, the government version, it isn't covered. NIST don't cover it. The Congress, when they looked into it, they didn't cover it in their 500 plus page report. It's not covered. It's a huge smoking gun, and it's so simple.
Well, as I said, it's not a smoking gun. It's a smoking artillery brigade. It's the whole thing sitting out there.
Well, can you, maybe the last statement I'd like to hear from you before we call this a show, the statement you made on the Tierney and Glenn show, the USS Liberty Hour, you said that in your research you are convinced to a man 100% that the Israeli Mossad and elements within the American government were involved and complicit in the 9/11 attack on the United States. And the world, for that matter. Would you be willing to make that same statement again on our program?
I would, and I think that it's a combination of expertise, motivation, access, and a capability to evade.
Yep.
They have it.
They have it.
And more specifically, as I mentioned to you when we were talking earlier, One of the first questions that strategic analysts and intelligence analysts are taught to ask when you're looking at an event is who benefits.
Yeah, key bono.
The basic question is who benefits. And if you look at the wars, at the convulsion of anti-Islamic, anti-Arab sentiment in America, at everything that came out of 9/11, the only country in the world that benefited from this is Israel. Now, a lot of defense contractors in America are making a lot of money, but at a national level, the only country that benefits is Israel. And for openers, I would start with that.
Thanks, Alan. Appreciate it. Dr. Zabrowski. You're a great man. You're great, great example for others.
Yep.
And I'm very grateful for you to have done this show with myself and Noel. I'll let you give your final things here, and I guess we'll call this recording.
You know, just put things into people that can chew in on. 3,000 people died on 9/11, and 4 million have died since then. You would DU. Weaponry, white phosphorus and starvation and whatever, that's the equivalent of the Republic of Ireland. My home country have died since 9/11. You know, real people have died. This isn't a game. I'd like to thank our guest Alan for coming on. I would encourage him to keep up with his articles, and Alan isn't just a one-article guy. He showed up 2 weeks ago with an article. You can go back and read his comments about Gaza. You can go on to Philip Mondo's website, and there's a couple of articles posted there. He's a prolific writer, and he seems to be getting very finely tuned into this criminal network. And I congratulate him. I'd like to thank him for coming on. I'll leave you the last words, Alan. Pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.